U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
President Biden reverses course on signing a bipartisan infrastructure bill, and the Justice Department files a lawsuit against Georgia's new voting law. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Jason Willick. The White House spent the weekend cleaning up Joe Biden's statement on Thursday that he might not sign his own bipartisan infrastructure deal. On Thursday, he'd announced a $1.2 trillion agreement with a handful of Republican senators. And then later that day, he said he'd only sign it if the Senate also passed a bigger bill on what he keeps calling human infrastructure. And it was interesting that on Saturday, the White House released a written statement from the president explaining that, whoops, that's not really what he meant at all. He said his comment understandably upset some Republicans and, quote, created the impression that I was issuing a veto threat on the very plan I had just agreed to, which was certainly not my intent, unquote. Kim, what do you make of this this instance of damage control?
Well, it was President Joe Biden speaking truth the first time and then getting caught, because it certainly does seem to be his intent. Remember the history here. A group of bipartisan senators in the White House come out, announce this deal, lots of backslapping and handshaking. And just several hours later, Mr. Biden says he won't sign that bill unless he also gets everything else that he had wanted via a reconciliation bill. These are lots of things that Republicans outright oppose, including a number of new entitlement programs. And he said this because it's what the progressive left expects of him. They're very worried that the White House will simply go away along with a bipartisan infrastructure bill and that all of their priorities will be left to see if they can get through in a bigger provision that you may or may not have centrist Democrats supporting. So this was somewhat of a threat by connecting them together. Both Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer had said the same thing that day, so he was echoing those comments. Now the attempted cleanup, and we'll have to see how many Republicans actually buy that, whether or not the White House is operating in good faith, or whether or not the bipartisan bill they negotiated is going to be held hostage to a larger spending blowout.
Yeah. And just as a matter of watching President Biden, though, I mean, one of the questions on Friday when right after this happened was whether Biden was intentionally doing this, strategically double crossing those Republicans that he was negotiating with, or whether he just simply was talking off the cuff and got a little bit ahead of his skis, didn't quite have the strategy nailed down in his own mind. And his defense is that he's just saying it's the latter. And Joe Biden, it's true, has never been the most focused guy with rhetorical discipline. But Jason, I don't know if you agree, as president so far, I thought he's been pretty tightly focused on his message. And it was interesting to see this is a place where the White House was playing cleanup.
Yeah, this is one of the first times he's really stepped on his own message in such an overt way. I think it has to do with the political dynamics, which is everyone assumed, or the sort of media conventional wisdom and Democratic conventional wisdom is, you know, if only we could work together, you know, but Republicans will just block everything. That's why we need to nuke the filibuster. You know, Mitch McConnell is obstructionist. Okay, well, let's see if we can negotiate with them. Let's try this infrastructure negotiation. And lo and behold, Republicans, or 10 of them or 12 of them or however many are on this group, come to a preliminary agreement. So that sort of undermines this whole talking point that Republicans are going to obstruct anything that Democrats want to do. It turns out they just don't want to go along with the more extreme measures. But anyway, that sort of, I think, threw a wrench in a lot of people's mental construction of how Washington is supposed to work and how the Republicans are supposed to operate. And so it got the White House and the Democrats confused.
But at least some of these Republicans seem to have accepted Biden's walk back, and they're essentially saying no harm, no foul. Here's Ohio Senator Rob Portman on ABC over the weekend. Here's what he said. We were all blindsided by the comments the previous day, which were that somehow these two bills were connected. The reconciliation, which is trillions of dollars of social spending that is going to be entirely partisan, the largest tax increase in American history. And on the other hand, the infrastructure bill, which is bipartisan, has no taxes, focuses on core infrastructure, and has been bipartisan from the start. So it was a surprise, to say the least, that these two got linked, and I'm glad they've been delinked. Unquote. And Kim, what is notable about that to me is the pretense that these two bills have gotten delinked now, because it seems to me that they're still obviously linked in everyone's mind.
Right. Now, Portman was a lead on this. You also have Mitt Romney coming out on CNN's State of the Union, also on Sunday, saying that the waters have been calmed by Biden's statement. But that is not the case for most Republicans. That's not their view. And so it was very notable that Mitch McConnell then came out and pointed out the obvious problem here, which is that the White House can say that they have been delinked, but the White House does not control the legislative process. And what's going to be more important, and what the White House, he expected the White House to do, was to pressure Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer to explicitly say that they were delinked. And it's going to be very obvious whether or not that goes to be the case. Do you have the Senate move when it gets back from recess to draft and pass this bill on its own? Do you see the House do the same thing? Or is there a very obvious strategy to not move one without reconciliation moving in tandem? And so this is going to be a pretty obvious thing. Now, the White House is certainly posing as if they've now delinked them, and that they've embarked on a sort of flogging tour. They're out trying to build up pressure. President Biden is in Wisconsin today, pushing for the legislation. The Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, has been doing some promoting of it. But again, the real test here is going to be, do Schumer and Pelosi agree to put this bill forward and then let the chips fall where they may with reconciliation later?
But with the Senate split 50-50, even if Schumer and Pelosi agree to, quote unquote, delink these two bills, any single member of the Democratic caucus in the Senate can decide he's not going to go along with that. And I say he here because I'm referring to Bernie Sanders, who has tweeted this. Let me be clear, there will not be a bipartisan infrastructure deal without a reconciliation bill that substantially improves the lives of working families and combats the existential threat of climate change. No reconciliation bill, no deal, unquote. I mean, Jason, do you take him seriously there? Do you think he would be the guy that torpedoes the bipartisan bill that that Joe Biden has negotiated?
No. I mean, what's striking about Bernie Sanders is the extent that, you know, he really, at the end of the day, is a team player. You know, unlike sort of some renegade figures on the right, I don't think you see him really willing to blow up his party's agenda and his president's agenda. So I think, you know, there may be something in between. He may say, oh, I have assurances, you know, from Schumer, and that we're going to move ahead with the family's plan, spending many trillions of dollars. But, you know, for now, the right thing to do is to vote for this and get what I can. So I see him. I do not see him, you know, sinking the whole thing. I see him, you know, making this statement as pressure to get more assurances for his reconciliation bill. But, you know, even that could run into some trouble as the specifics start getting scrutinized.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, This is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Kim, I mean, I guess the argument that I'm trying to make here more broadly is that even if everybody agrees to, quote unquote, de-link these two bills, the whole underlying political structure here, it just insists that they are not de-linked. So first of all, you've had these Democrats insisting for a long time that Joe Biden can go forward with this bipartisan negotiation, and whatever doesn't get in the smaller bill, we're going to add to the bigger bill. So that's a clear linkage there. And then, at least as I understand the Republican argument to do this bipartisan negotiation, is that if you can pass a smaller bill that's roads and bridges and things that you know, Senate Democratic moderates like Joe Manchin want, then maybe you can make it harder or prevent the bigger bill from passing, or at least can make it harder for that to get through the Senate. So in both of the political incentives here on the Democrats and the Republicans seem to insist that it's impossible to delink these things.
Well, I agree that I find it very hard to believe that a Bernie Sanders, or, and he's not alone, there's a number of other progressives in the Senate who have made the same insistence that there's going to have to be two bills. But I find it very hard to believe that any of them would agree to vote on an infrastructure bill in the Senate absent some sort of at least broad agreement from Joe Manchin and others on a reconciliation bill, the contours and the main provisions in it. That to me is the question of linkage. And so we'll have to see. Now, they got a little bit of a good news on Sunday when Joe Manchin went on TV and said, okay, I'm actually up for a reconciliation bill. And said that he would be willing to support raising the corporate tax rate to 25% and increasing capital gains taxes to 28% to help pay for the bill. But here was also his limitation. He said, quote, if they think in reconciliation, I'm going to throw caution to the wind and go to $5 trillion or $6 trillion when we can only afford $1 trillion or $1.5 trillion or maybe $2 trillion and what we can pay for, then I can't be there. That was Manchin this weekend. So do they end up coming up with some broad top line number, a way to pay for it, a broad agreement on what provisions would go in there? Is $2 trillion enough for Bernie Sanders? You know, that's what we're going to be looking at here. But just in terms of the infrastructure bill, I find it hard to believe that the Senate would end up having a vote that would get 60 votes absent some sort of prior arrangement on reconciliation.
Right. And what that arrangement might look like is yet to be determined. And I'll just underline the point Kim made. I'll read the quote from Joe Manchin. He said, I want to make sure we pay for it. I do not want to add more debt on. So if that's $1 trillion or $1.5 trillion or $2 trillion, whatever that comes to be out over a 10-year period, that's what I would be voting on, unquote. And Jason, so this is one of the unknowns also. I mean, Bernie's proposed $5 trillion. There you have Joe Manchin saying, maybe I could go to $2 trillion. Well, I mean, there's a pretty enormous gap between $5 trillion and $2 trillion. And we're talking about writing a piece of legislation.
Right. And then there's the, you know, third factor for the infrastructure bill, which is if Joe Manchin, you know, gives an agreement, like Kim said, toward Bernie's Bernie Sanders's reconciliation bill, is that then too big, such a big number, and it appears so linked to infrastructure that then you have Republicans balking at the infrastructure bill? And I guess my intuition is that Joe Manchin wants to pull it off so that the initial infrastructure bill does pass as kind of a proof of concept for his idea, you know, we can work together, we can work with Republicans, we don't need to eliminate the filibuster. But there's two sides, as he's having to negotiate with Bernie on one side, you know, somewhere between $1 and $5 trillion. And then what's the number at which the Republicans will get off the train if he goes too high? So it's quite a complicated sort of game theory situation.
The other thing to keep in mind, and the Journal has an editorial on this today, is when we're talking about a $2 trillion bill and or a $5 trillion bill, I mean, the one-time cost of that is obviously something that needs to be taken into account, and those are huge numbers. But it's also important, Kim, not to forget the expansions of entitlement programs that would be part of that. And Biden has proposed a federal program for childcare, paid family leave, free community college, increased child tax credits, universal pre-K. And so, Kim, the another of the unknowns here is if the bill that is in a 10-year budget window, say, is $5 trillion, what do those programs cost? Because they're not going to be repealed after that 10-year window.
Well, yeah, here's what we do know. It's not going to be the number that is in that bill. And you can bet that as Democrats go forward with this reconciliation, that this is going to be an enormous part of it, sort of playing with the rules in a way that allows them to make the cost of these things look a lot less than they actually will be. You know, when you look at the Biden family's plan, for instance, it pretends that the child tax credit ends in 2025. So its cost is about $450 billion over the 10-year budget window. But it's not going to end in 4 years from now, obviously. So start doing that math and extrapolate out how much it will really cost, and then do that for all of the entitlement programs that have been included in there. Government paid family leave, free community college, the new higher tax credit per child, the expansion of Obamacare premium subsidies, universal pre-K, the list goes on, federal child care. So go ahead and look at those numbers, but understand that they are utterly dishonest. And whatever they say this is going to cost, it's going to cost several times more than that.
Finally, on Friday, the Justice Department announced that it was filing a lawsuit against Georgia, alleging that its recently passed new voting law discriminates against non-white voters. Jason, what did you make of that news?
Well, it's not entirely surprising, or not at all surprising. It would be embarrassing for the president if he said that this Georgia legislation was like Jim Crow, but that his Justice Department couldn't do anything about it. That said, I think the lawsuit is weak on the merits because, you know, basically the bill keeps voting more easily accessible than it was before the pandemic. It repeals some of the measures that were supposed to be emergency measures that took effect during the pandemic. So I think it's a stretch to argue that Georgia has been, you know, basically violating the Voting Rights Act for many years before the pandemic, and that many other states have been doing so with their own restrictions on mail-in voting. That said, I would say that the one, you know, what the lawsuit leans on is it leans on sort of political remarks by Georgia politicians, by other politicians. It leans on, you know, President Trump's, you know, false statements about the election to sort of say that this bill was based on, you know, misinformation and falsehood and sort of, you know, the president's, you know, political efforts to overturn the election. So, you know, just once again, if it is struck down, or if at least a federal court gives it some trouble and enjoins it before, you know, an appellate court overturns them, you know, part of the blame will go to these Republicans who latched onto false claims about the election, because that just gives ammunition to people trying to overturn the law. They can stack the lawsuit with those kinds of statements to argue that there's animus and malintent that sort of infects the whole legislative effort. So that's another mistake by the Republican side. But that said, I think that the lawsuit should fail, and probably will mostly fail when it goes through the courts.
But what struck me, to your point, Jason, is that the lawsuit alleges bad motives on the part of the state legislature, saying that lawmakers, quote, intended to deny or abridge the right of Black Georgians to vote, unquote. But then what follows after that mostly reads like a disparate impact argument. And just to take one example, so the old deadline to request a mail ballot was Friday before the election. and they've moved that now to 11 days before the election. And the lawsuit says essentially that that period that is eliminated, Black voters were more likely to file absentee requests in that period. But Kim, I guess my thought is that Georgia is going to come back with its reply, and it's going to say, if you request an absentee ballot the Friday before the election, that doesn't leave very much time for us to process it and to get it mailed out to you, for the voter to fill it out, for the voter to possibly mail it back, depending on where they are, what their circumstances are. And then on top of that, Kim, I mean, that's a neutral rule. So how does it seems there's a gap. The Justice Department is trying to divine bad intent from a neutral rule change like that.
Correct. And, you know, just to further make your point, even the U.S. Postal Service, which is a federal agency, has urged states to leave 2 weeks to manage two-way delivery of absentee ballots. So I think it'd be very hard to argue that this new deadline in some way is specifically targeting particular races of voters to make it harder for them to vote. You know, there's another example. One of the provisions the lawsuit also notes is Georgia's new law that changes the system. Instead of voting signatures, when you apply for a mail ballot, you have to supply a state ID number or a copy of some other identifying document, even like a utility bill. And the lawsuit is saying that this somehow particularly burdens Black voters. But if that's the case, why have Democrats like Joe Manchin proposed and supported a similar kind of nationwide ID rule? And again, if you're really looking at the impact of this on different types of voters, this could actually help Black voters. And that if you look at Georgia's 2018 election, about Black voters accounted for 54% of the ballots that were rejected for signature or oath issues. So this could actually facilitate a greater acceptance rate of ballots. But the entire lawsuit is like this. It's basically making the argument that anything that was thrown out there during COVID-19 now must be the standard for voting, and that anything else somehow doesn't make the cut. And it should put all new attention on some of these voting laws that Democrats are now trying to pass at the federal level, one of which H.R. 4 would essentially give the Department of Justice the ability to impose these varying standards all over the country again through something called preclearance. And you can see with this lawsuit just how much of a partisan exercise that might end up being.
Yeah. And the other strange thing I thought about the DOJ's lawsuit is that the Supreme Court is currently hearing, it heard, it's going to release its opinion shortly, a similar case from Arizona. And it's called Brnovich v. Democratic National Committee. And it involves a couple of very similar legal issues on Arizona's voting law changes. And the Justice Department didn't wait for that ruling to file its lawsuit. And so if it had waited a week, it might have had a better sense of what the Supreme Court's view of some of these issues are, might have written its complaint, its legal complaint, a little bit differently. And Jason, it's interesting. So the Supreme Court in 2013 struck down the application of this preclearance regime on states like Georgia. And that was an opinion that was decided on June 25th, 2013. And the Justice Department filed its lawsuit on June 25th, 2021. And so there are some people that are saying essentially that the reason the Justice Department didn't wait is that the Attorney General was trying to make kind of a statement. So what do you make of that thought, Jason?
I think that's right. I mean, I might put it a little bit differently. I think Merrick Garland is a smart lawyer and knows that the lawsuit that he's filed is politically, you know, motivated and dubious and unlikely to succeed. And, you know, it may be that there's a big defeat for the Democrats in the Arizona Supreme Court case that comes out likely this week. So, you know, it may be that this lawsuit was filed before that deliberately to just get ahead of that loss and to just show that the administration is fighting this.
Well, it'll be interesting to watch. Thank you, Kim and Jason. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.